to you live from Midtown New York. It is Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. How you feeling? Brand new year, brand new month. That's a brand new day. Hope it's treating you well. Got a great show coming your way. Got a lot of ground to cover. Going to meet Alan Ross. Alan Ross is from the Samaritans Organization of New York City. The Samaritans of New York operates the only community-based organization in the New York City metropolitan area solely devoted to preventing suicide and helping people in crisis. We're going to be talking music. We're going to be talking politics, decluttering your life, all kinds of compelling topics. Shutdown continues. I just can't wrap my head around this. Last night I was half asleep on the couch, and I remember waking up and remember seeing a Republican. I'm not sure who he was. Couldn't tell. And he was saying, this is an easy thing to resolve, an easy issue. But of course, you know who is at the helm, and it doesn't make it easy. It makes everything very, very difficult and arduous. I feel so bad. My heart breaks for all the people who are living check to check, who are obviously past their first pay cycle, without being paid, and possibly defaulting on a loan, rent, a numerous amount of financial obligation that they cannot commit to, that they are committed to. A landlord's not going to say, hey, listen, I'm sorry Trump has closed the government, but I still need my rent. And just imagine, and I know for the most part, it's not Congress's fault. The majority of Congress does not want a wall or barrier, for the most part, from what I've read. But you know, if they were ever missing a paycheck, or if Trump was ever being denied a service, money, whatever it would be important to him, do you think he would sacrifice something for himself? No way at all. No way. So it's really, really disheartening to think of this happening in the United States of America, 2019, and we're an evolved nation. A nation that can, you know, provide so much, and yet we just have somebody who's so stubborn and pigheaded in the Oval Office because, as a matter of fact, I read something the other day. Actually, no, I didn't read it. I want to read it, about him saying a clip from years ago before he was in a political race, about saying how his viewpoints against the wall, and he contradicted himself, or now he's contradicting himself. So, you know, there was a campaign promise, and he's still catering to his base, however small that is, and it's definitely going to cause a lot of damage. And the last thing I'll say to him is that, say on this topic, is that it's clear to see that if he doesn't get this, he's going to act out, you know, a lot more irrational ways. And secondly, it's been clear that obviously 2020, you know, he's done. His goose is cooked. He can't get anything done. So I think that's what he's really focused on. So what's scary is if he goes to the next step and calls an emergency crisis and takes the reins and, you know, puts Congress in the backseat, et cetera. Anyway, so let's keep fingers crossed. Let's see if he has a breakdown or an epiphany, sees the light and realizes that a wall's not the answer. And you know what? Listen, let's give people, let's fund the budget for a month or 60 days. Let's get the wheels turning again and then continue talks. Maybe that'll just take the pressure off him a bit. I read also just a headline that he stormed out of the office yesterday, I think, with Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. Doesn't surprise me, like a bull in a china shop. And so the talks ceased again. So I was a big fan of Lance Armstrong, huge fan of Lance Armstrong as an outdoor cyclist, that I always looked up to him for numerous reasons. Number one, the fact that he could just be such a stellar and elite athlete on many levels, to overcome so much, to prove to himself again and again and again, and to us, wink, wink, that he was just indomitable. And I was on the Lance Armstrong wagon for years. I always was, you know, praise the guy. I always bought the Sports Illustrated issue. I was always into watching him on the Tour de France. I think I even bought a hat. I'm not one of these people who go out and buy other people's clothing just because, you know, you're fans. You know, a lot of people are, and that's cool, but I just don't like to wear other people's stuff because it's like, if you're not paying me to wear your material or clothing, then I'm not going to wear it. Anyway, so I would be a huge fan. And then, you know, the doping insinuations came out, and I was agreeing with most of the cycle community in terms of fans that, you know what, he's not doping because he is such an advanced athlete, because he puts in the time and effort, and he did. It wasn't like he was sitting on the couch hoping to win another Tour de France without a lot of effort. He was out there mile after mile, month after month, year after year, Pyrenees after Pyrenees, doing his thing. He worked his tail off. He was committed, like an elite athlete should be. So therefore, you know, it didn't really strike me as an obvious thing that he was actually doping. And then a few more years went by, and then more evidence came out. And I realized certainly in the past, other people have gotten caught doping. But then I realized, yes, it looks like more of the doctors are on the pay wagon. And it seemed more of a community, isolated, very isolated, close-knit community. And then it became more and more obvious. So anyway, it came out years later that, you know, after he defied everyone, how could I ever do such a thing to my body? I'm a purist. Sure, I take certain things to enhance my health, etc. Anything that I've done during my cancer and or pre or post could have some effect, could have shown up and caused some false positives, et cetera, et cetera. And then I realized, okay, this guy's full of BS. Yes, he is still an incredible athlete. I give him that, and I will always give him that because, again, of what I just mentioned before about how incredibly, I mean, to ride on a bicycle for 20, 21 days, anywhere from 80 to 120 miles plus a day on ascents that are just, you know, that a car can hardly drive up. And just, you know, just be murderous on the breakaways and everything. And yes, even if he was doping, but he wasn't doping for a certain amount of years because you can tell because of his timing, of his testing, any cyclist out there. And then it comes down to this. If the entire league, say the NFL, NHL, NBA, Cycling Federation, if all these cyclists are doing it and you're not doing it, and it's such a highly, highly competitive field, will you be dropped? Will you lose your sponsorship? There's so many different compelling facts that are major variables, significant. But the reality is you have to ask yourself, do you want to be in this sport, this world, if you're not being true to yourself and true to the sport? It's very difficult. Think about, you know, dedicating a lifetime, 20 years, you're finally at the pinnacle of your sport, and someone approaches you and says, listen, the rest of the team is doing this. You have to do it. And there you are. Everything you worked for is questioned. Ethically, morally, you have to ask yourself, should I do this? Why should I do this? Should I pull the plug? If I pull the plug, they're going to turn it around and blacklist you. You will be defaced from the sport. You will be an outcast. And then there goes your opportunity to fulfill your dream, possibly not to win the tour, but maybe come in the top 20, top 50, maybe just complete the tour. But you need a sponsor. It costs a boatload of money. One of those bikes alone costs anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000. Yes, I kid you not, $10,000 to $20,000. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'll put it in perspective. If I need a new cycling bike, I'm an outdoor cyclist, and I can't buy it. The reason why I can't buy it, because I have two kids and I have to save for their college education, because a new bike that I would need to buy would cost anywhere from $4,000 to $5,000. And that's just for me because it's a high-end bike. It's not a tour-worthy bike, but it's a high-end bike that's very light, geared to handle and react and to respond with very, very quick precision. But can I rationalize spending that on my, well, let me see, do my math, income tax time, check return. No, still can't do it. I actually, a sidebar here, I had two roofers over the other day. Welcome to January, ladies and gentlemen. I have two leaks in my house, but luckily they're in the bathroom. So, you know, worst case scenario, the best thing to do is have a leak over the tub or the toilet. So $13,000 later, I get an estimate for a roof saying it's really bad condition. I'm like, yes, why? I kind of thought so, because that's why there's water coming into the house. So that's my reality, $13,000 for a new roof in January. Hello. So $4,000 bicycle, two kids. Yeah, it's not going to happen. So anyway, I want to play a clip because this is the first interview that Lance gave in, I think, 6 years when he last was seen on TV crying in front of Oprah. After he was on TV for years, staring completely at the camera saying, I did not take any doping-enhancing drugs, anything of this caliber. So watch this, and we'll talk about this on the outside.
I think if you polled the world, the first issue, doping in the sport of cycling at that generation, I think most people now have enough history and enough knowledge to know that, gosh, look like everybody did it. That isn't the issue for people. The issue is how I so aggressively defended myself, being litigious, going after people. That's the thing.
Lying.
Well, yeah. We all lied. I mean, at no point were you just going to say, you know what, I'm kind of sick of lying. I'm going to tell you the truth. But, of course, there were lies. But even then, people, this notion of this idea of bullying is a terrible look. I mean, I say it all the time. I mean, when I watch old clips, because I get to watch them either through lawsuits or just whatever, the way I acted, if I saw one of my children act that way, I mean, it would be a very rough conversation.
Yes, it would be a rough conversation, because you know why? You know what it's like to actually be dishonest with people, to the American people, to the entire world, because so many people, you made actually Lance Armstrong popularized the sport of cycling. Do you know how difficult that is? I mean, until then, in 1984, there's the first American cyclist, and his name is slipping my mind. Great guy. I met him. I interviewed him. It'll come back to me. He was on the 7-Eleven team, an incredible athlete, and he was devoted. He devoted his life to bring out this news and to strip Lance of his 7 yellow jerseys, 7 Tour de France titles. And it came out, and he was dethroned, rightfully so. But the thing is that gets me the interview, I don't know if it bothered you, he talks, basically, he doesn't seem like he's changed. It seems like he's talking for what he thinks the people want to hear, because he, I guess, has an investment company now, because he's made a boatload of money. And I don't know how much money he actually had to return in terms of sponsorships. It all depends, I guess, the phrasing of the contracts. And I'm sure a lot of them, certainly since then, any major athlete is going to have different clauses, whether they're caught in scandals or they deface a product or their sport or their image, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is, I don't think he's learned a damn thing. You know, he's talking about bullying in that clip. He's talking about everyone lies. I mean, he's trying to justify what he did. There's no justification. You blatantly lied for years, defiantly. I mean, like as if your life depended on it. And I guess in certain situations, I guess you thought it did, because your reputation had got so built, you built it up so entirely to a gargantuan level that you had to live in this house of lies. And I was wondering one other final thought on this matter. If in 2019 or 2018, if this scandal would have broke, if the timing of 6 years would have made a difference. And I think it would have made a difference because, and this is a bad reason why, so many people lie. Politicians, stars, celebrities, people in the public eye. But America has amnesia. It's like we allow these people to go away for a little while, like the Elliot Spitzers of the world. Remember the first person to actually get caught like doing something in a sexual manner on TV? Marv Albert, cross-dressing. And he's back. And you know what? Hey, cross-dressing, if you want to wear a woman's lingerie outfit in a hotel, you know, that's fine. But that really pales in comparison to what people are doing nowadays. So I wonder if Lance Armstrong, 6 years ago, if this took place today, if we would have a different reaction. I think two things. Number one, the fact that he lied for so long, and really misled the American and the world, I don't think that would have that would still be scarring, and people would really be dejected over that, about his lack of being candid. But number two, I think overall, I think he would have more forgiveness because he's so far from being alone nowadays. Look at the head of state, our commander in chief. Case in point. Enough said. Mark Farrell, the show's Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Love to hear your input. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Alan Ross is a great man, executive director of the Samaritan's Suicide Prevention Center right here in New York City. And he and I were introduced, we were trying to figure this out the other day, probably around 1992, 93. And I don't think it's been, it's probably been about 15 years since we've seen each other. And with suicide, certainly on not the decline, sadly to say, on the rise still. I thought it warranted for Alan to come on and to educate PRN listeners about what they do, their vital mission, and what you can do to help this. Alan Ross, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
You look damn good.
Well, time does pass, but especially on radio, it works much better.
So. Well, we have images of you, so you can't hide from the world now.
No, you can't, I guess.
I actually remember being on a TV show with you. I think it was on Channel 7 we did a segment.
Could be. It was the early days of cable. Well, but some of the early stuff was out of Jersey.
That's true. Right? I think it was on the Upper West Side, so it was 7. But it was great because there's still always interest, certainly, in something that's so prevalent that robs tens of thousands of lives annually. And unfortunately, this is still something that exists in a society that's so prevalent on so many different issues with drug and addiction use. Obviously, mental health is something that's never not been a vital component. But I think, of course, with all the stressors in our life, it's even more so present, omnipresent.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we talk about suicide, we tend to focus on kind of the dark, sensational, melodramatic aspect
stigmas
of it, and not that there's not tragedy and obviously tremendous darkness in it, but really suicide is an outcome from people struggling to cope with whatever problem they have. And it can be tied to mental health, obviously. It can be tied to economics. I just was reading a piece yesterday about with the furlough of federal
call
workers.
Call what you like, right?
That a lot of, and I don't know if this report, I was a former journalist, so I take all this with a grain of salt.
Okay.
Yeah. But a report said as many as 25% of the federal workforce are former veterans. So you have people who have already been exposed to tremendous violence, potential trauma.
PTSD.
We know all the different aspects of things, or we don't know all, but we have an inkling. So now on top of it, they're in the workforce, so not being able to get paid, not be able to take care of your family, not be able to deal with your daily things.
Buy groceries.
Whoever it may be. Yeah. And this impacts all people in different ways. But it's just a good example of people who might be considered are a higher risk population. And here you have an exacerbating factor that makes matters worse. So, you know, we talk about suicide. We could be talking about trauma. We could be talking about economics. We could talk about sexual identity. Anything that impacts people, and you're impacted the way you feel it, not the way other people perceive it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I could be the most handsome and striking person in the world, but if I broke my nose when I was a teenager, so when I look in the mirror, I don't see what used to be bright blue eyes, or I don't see before the beard what was a dimple in a cleft chin. I saw a guy with a broken nose, and I could have a lot of girlfriends or whatever feedback or positive response I got. But it's what it is to me. Perception is everything. And everyone who's listening knows how you feel about something is how you feel about it. It doesn't matter what someone tells you.
And when they tell you to get over it, it's not something you can do.
Yeah, but one of my lines is people say snap out of it, and it is not something to be snapped out of. You know, it's we're all very cavalier in other people's issues and problems. We do an exercise in the Samaritan's Hotline training. And one of the things we say, when you're overwhelmed, when you're depressed, what turns you off, what makes you regret reaching out for help? And almost everybody says, I don't like people telling me they understand. You understand. I'm the one going through it. How can you say, you don't like people giving you advice? Yeah, you know, I know if I could stop eating, you know, 3 pounds of cookies and 2 liters of Coke a day, I would be okay. But recognizing it.
So vernacular is huge. So you referred to the hotline that you have, the Samaritan's hotline here, which is the only private-based phone line in existence, correct, in New York City?
Well, it's the only completely confidential service. And the fascinating thing about Samaritan's is it's run completely 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
365.
By volunteers, unpaid volunteers.
That is incredible.
I volunteered in the days when the Village Voice was a newspaper we all read.
Remember that?
And loved, yeah.
Went free.
Yeah, we used to have an ad. Yeah, before it went free is right. There was an ad on the back that said, good listeners needed. And in 1984, I was journalist. I responded to that ad, even though my girlfriend at the time said, it says good listeners needed. I don't know. I'm still with Samaritans, but I'm not with her anymore.
Exactly.
So.
Well, we understand. You got to lose some weight, right? That's pretty miraculous. And the number that I find very, very impressive is the 1.2 million calls fielded by the hotline.
Yeah, actually 1.3 at this point. Yeah. And that's in spite of constant funding problems and challenges in just keeping the service operational. Most funding these days goes to research, clinical services, government programs, and in all frankness, which is something that truly bothers a lot of us in the field, the community-based groups, the volunteer-based groups really don't get the attention, support, and resources.
Well, these are the people that are in the trenches because, listen, there's a lot of other organizations out there doing great work, and we're going to get to your programmatic side, but the reality is, at 1 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, when it's a dark, vital, critical time for someone, you guys are there.
Yeah, I mean, without getting into too much of the details, as tempting as it is, when government officials cut our funding, I send a little note saying, well, at 3 o'clock in the morning, do you want the people calling you? And even mental health professionals. And, you know, everybody makes a good effort, tries to do good work, so nothing's meant to disparage anybody's efforts. But the bottom line is, if you're a professional clinician, you're not letting a client call you in the middle of the night or even 3 times during the day.
You're parameters. You're lucky if you get limits. A call back in the morning.
Yeah. Well, but even a responsive, caring, sensitive, there's parameters, there's guidelines, there's frameworks, there's funding. So having these always immediately available, ongoing emotional support, what we refer to in some ways as kind of mental health maintenance, which I think all of us could use. We'll leave out the commander-in-chief just to be politically correct. But it's something they're called protective factors. And the more protective factors you have in your life, family, friends, your mother was a great example of an engaging, supportive, caring person. When I first met you, it was obvious that you had her support and care. I had a mother who's passed who would say, I may not always agree with you, honey, but, I'm always there.
And that's invaluable.
Right. So that those supportive factors, your spiritual, your religious beliefs, your you exercise, that's an outlet, that's a support, engaging with people in your community, certainly professional and support help. Anything that gives you a place to get grounded, some relief of pressure relief, some way to get through the moment. In fact, and one of the first statements we make in Samaritan's Hotline training is you don't solve other people's problems for them. It's hard enough to handle your own. You don't save someone's life. You help him or her get through a moment, this moment, now. So it's very immediate. You know, we're not solving your life. We're not fixing things. We're not changing your perceptions. We're helping you now, providing support in a empathetic and respectful way, not through empathy, which is meeting someone at their own level, not sympathy. Oh, you poor kid. That's so bad. I wish that hadn't happened, you know. There's a lot of it's fascinating because suicide prevention work really isn't about death and dying. It's how do we relate to one another? How do we communicate with each other? And how do we respond? And I think this is what you were pointing to. How do we respond to people when they're at their most fragile, their most vulnerable? And any one of us at any time can face a situation we have trouble getting through.
So a couple points. Number one, Alan Ross, is that the fact is we all know how important a sounding board is, whether we have a mental health issue or crisis or not. Speaking to a loved one, a friend, a therapist, whatever the case may be, we feel like 5 pounds, 10 pounds lighter. You could skip down a block. So imagine being in a crisis mode and having the ability to have, without sounding corny, a lifeline to someone else who, you know, is going to be there. And we're going to follow up with some other questions in a moment. But the reality is it's just the aspect where you know you can talk to another human being, where your point before about calling a physician, you're not going to get these answers. To actually hear another human voice on the phone will allow them to feel like there is someone in this world who I can talk to, who's there for me. And they may have their own sensibility and or definition of why this works for them. But the reality is someone is there in a dark time, and that's totally invaluable. And the fact that these people are there manning this crisis line 24/7, 365 as a volunteer and as you started is just truly remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, I work at Samaritans. I was a volunteer there. I didn't create the place, so I can be very suitably impressed by
it. Equally so, sure.
Samaritans actually is part of a worldwide, when, I know you know this, but I'm telling your listeners, it's the world's oldest and largest suicide prevention network. It created the world's first suicide hotline over 65 years ago.
That's amazing.
And there's affiliated centers following our practices and principles in 42 countries, over 400 centers, with something like 25 or 30,000 volunteers around the world.
And a descendant of the Dickens family started it up in Boston in terms of the stateside?
On the stateside, very good. You remember your history. Monica Dickens, the great-granddaughter of Charles Dickens, was friendly with Chad Vara, the Anglican minister who founded Samaritans, a minister with a degree in psychotherapy, created a non-religious, non-clinical volunteer network. And Monica Dickens brought it to Cape Cod and to Boston in the middle 70s. And it's as well known, my assistant, longest support staff, is from County Cork in Ireland. And people in Great Britain and Ireland grew up with Samaritans the way we grew up with, like, the Red Cross.
Fantastic.
Or the Salvation Army. Great. So they know it.
Ubiquitous.
It's
yeah.
part of their culture, mm-hmm. not so much in New York or the States.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. He started this foundation or organization back then because he was so upset about finding out that people died by suicide then.
Right. I mean, there's a classic story of certainly in the early 50s in England, the church and the education system were very closely connected, and there was tremendous limits on education tied to personal development, biology, sexuality, and the way the story is told. And I had the opportunity to meet Reverend Vara before he passed. There was a young woman in his parish, and he was called into her to her house, and she had to be like 14 or so, and she had awakened in the night, found herself covered in blood, which ultimately after the fact was construed to be she probably had her first period, but not having education and awareness of her own biology,
sure.
her own development, must have concluded she had committed some terrible sin, or who knows what secrets an adolescent might have, and before the sun came up, took her own life. And Vara was so outraged by the lack of willingness to engage, to embrace discussion of life issues, that he announced to the parish that he would be available whenever they needed to talk. Now, Vara has told this story, but I actually had him tell it to me. And when he told it to me, he wasn't happy about the outcome because his expectation was he's a psychotherapist. He's inviting the parish to come if they need something. And a lot of people came. And in those days, a lot of the churches, it may still be, I'm not sure, but it was the women of the community that kind of were the infrastructure, the people who held the services and programs and organization together. So these people would come to see Vara with a problem, and the women in the church would say, "Okay, dear, he'll be with you in a while. Please come on, sit down. Let's have a cup of tea. What's going on with you?" And he discovered after a week that the vast majority of people would come in, talk to these, quote, tea servers who were great listeners.
Open up.
They would
more
talk
so
for
then,
15,
sure.
20, 30 minutes, and they would leave. And he would come out and go, where'd everybody go?
The warm-up act took care of
and
everything.
And he developed out of this, he developed
what a
this
great concept.
Yeah, it's pretty logical.
Well, I mean, it comes down to basic communication, making people feel like they're comfortable and they want to be heard.
That's exactly right.
Without that variable of being depressed.
Right. And you'll remember me now and know how pedantic I can get. So it's not making them, which is a power word.
Yes.
But just providing the opportunity, allowing people to connect, to get their thoughts and feelings out. As you said before, people who swim together don't drown. So having that contact, having that connection. And part of this is we're not, I hate to say, effective communicators as a culture. I think the average American's level when they get out of college is an eighth grade reading level. I've been training hotline volunteers for 30 years, and the lack of basic communication skills from people with advanced degrees or, from postdocs.
Yeah, to state of society, sure.
Yeah, and even those of us that have a fairly
adept
is a good word, use of language, don't recognize, as I was teasing you, implications of some of our words or phrases, which actually we believe enhance stigma, such as,
oh, absolutely.
You need to get help. You need professional help. Behind that is, I'm okay, I'm strong,
I know
it's necessary. And it's almost like it's like sympathy. Mm. You poor thing. It patronizes, and it may not be conscious, but we want
it comes from a good place.
Yeah, but just because it comes from a good place, or just because
it's not received
your intent,
that way. Yeah,
communications, as you know, in the field,
absolutely,
it's how the message is received, not what you meant when you sent it.
There's a great quote, and I believe it stemmed from Mark Twain, and I could be totally wrong on this, but don't quote me. The fact is, people won't remember maybe what you said or what you did, but they will always remember how you made them feel.
That's we say. It's in, we train thousands and thousands of health providers in what we call, our approach is called befriending, which is really active listening, empathetic communication, structured communication, and has obviously a suicide risk assessment process to it. But it's befriending, and the point that we make is that befriending is a process. It's a connection. It's not an outcome. You're not trying to get somewhere to go where. You're being with them where they are. Mm.
And they're the guider. You're following along because obviously I imagine I can't put words in your mouth, but you have to assess where they're at, where they're going, and how you're befriending them and what level and how actively you're pursuing them.
Absolutely. We say you sit in the back seat, not in the front. But most of us, when we help, we want to take charge.
Oh, yeah.
We're working on
even my
a lot
kids
of our own
in the back
stuff.
Seat tell me how to drive.
Yeah.
Then again, I'm visually impaired, so they should probably tell me how to drive. So one of the multiple programs you have is a public education program, Alan Ross. Tell me about that.
We've been for over 30 years taking our approach, an approach that includes just basic humanistic behavior, but it also makes use of communications, science, and good clinical counseling practice. But it's a combination, the best of kind of all these worlds. And we share it with everyone from parent groups to community organizations. But the majority is to provide health providers with kind of the missing link. They're told what to do, but not really how do you do it. If you read some of the police manuals, and there's a lot of effort by police. We may not be satisfied with where it's at yet, but there's certainly a lot of effort by police.
It made progress.
To work with when there's calls tied to potential mental illness or something. If you read those guidelines, and one of them is called the CIT program, a very successful program. It says establish rapport with the a person. But what does that mean? How do you establish rapport? Establishing rapport is not just talking.
It's going to vary from one officer to another.
Well, in one way it varies, but it's where you position yourself. You're a response mode, not a take charge mode. It's the difference between, I mean, we're on media, Marshall McLuhan, probably no one's old enough to remember this, but really was the media communications guy.
Sure.
So from the McLuhan, you have a message to send, study your audience, figure out how to get them to understand your message, to the on being a better person, Rogers' approach to active listening, which is you receive a message first before you send. So there's a difference between being close-ended. Hey, Mark, I haven't seen you a while. Have things been going well? Well, it's not really I've already set the parameters for what the answer should be. Whereas, hey, Mark, how are you doing? How has it been? Well, now you can go anywhere you want. Now, it may not seem like a big difference, but it's a difference between having a preset response for you where you're kind of being pushed and chided. No student in class, when a professor says, "Do you understand?" wants to say no. The implication is you should understand, which is therefore a judgment. So you think you're asking a question, but even when you're going, "Well, honey, don't you think it would be good to talk about that?" you're not going, "What is it that's bothering you?" You're kind of pushing a judgment on what their behavior should be. So an active listening response makes it comfortable. It is rapport because you can go anywhere you want. And giving people the opportunity to go with what they feel or what they think at that given moment.
And not what they think you want them to go. Or the usual, "Hey, how you doing today? How's it going?" It's not really a question. It's a declarative statement.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have a another hat you should be wearing, a therapist, because obviously, you know.
What's that?
You have a very good therapist mentality.
Yeah, and no clinical training whatsoever.
Yes, exactly. Well, I mean, you don't need clinical training to be a good human being.
No, and yeah. You know, I can honestly say when I came to Samaritans half a lifetime ago, over 30 years ago, I was a pretty successful corporate communications consultant. I was a faculty of journalism, university journalism programs. I was a very successful writer, communicator. And I came to the hotline training, and boy, was it a slap in the face.
Yeah, I imagine. Wow.
Because almost everything I thought and knew, you know, it might work in a deadline media
situation.
Fashion.
Sure.
But even when I went back and I looked at how did we teach reporting? And reporting was – you know, today it's a little different with our internet.
Digital platform.
Am I allowed to say, quote, masturbatory media?
Oh, absolutely. Internet. Yeah. You can say whatever the fuck you – I'm sorry.
So, you know, with so much focus on what I think and what I feel tied to a story, which comes from journalistically the, Gail Sheehy and Norman Mailer and Tom Wolfe.
Wow, yeah.
The new journalism.
Yes, absolutely.
But it went to an extreme. The new journalism was, let's not be cold about information. Let's get into it so we can give it dimension. But it wasn't, except for Hunter Thompson, with multiple sources of intoxication, kind of lost the focus. And
you lost
he became
Hunter
the story. you know Hunter Thompson?
No, I don't.
Hell's Angels. And today, so much of it, and it's hard as a former journalist and someone who taught journalism to see so much self-reflective stuff. I don't even know what the whole story is. You're so busy talking about yourself.
Well, a lot of it doesn't have depth. I know we're getting on a tangent here.
Well, but
it
really
isn't
depth. Because it's that same concept of communication.
Yes.
That in me helping you, I focus on myself. Mm. What I think, what I went through. Well, you have siblings. You don't see the things the same way your sister does.
How did you know that? You can see the bubble over my head?
Well, you can just, you know, you just know.
Of course.
You know, every child thinks they're the favorite. Or every child thinks they didn't get the attention they need.
Exactly.
You know?
So, it's either acceptance or blame.
So you can have the same genetics. You can have the same background. You can have the same education. You can have the same upbringing. But perspective, even your own perspective, how you see something today, it'll
changes.
Be different.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So we say you never know what anybody's thinking. Mm. You never know what anybody's feeling. When you think you do, it's not about them. It's about you.
Absolutely.
And if we're going to be responsive to people, we need to put the focus on them and is learn basically to shut up. And that doesn't mean even just verbally. It also means the constant color commentary, like you brought up Matt Albert.
Sure.
We've got to. And, well, he's saying he needs this, but really what he needs, because I know from knowing him, you know, and you're deciding what people think and feel. But if someone did that to you, it would shut you down.
Absolutely.
And turn you off.
39 minutes past the hour in New York City. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on a Progressive Radio Network. Alan Ross is my guest today. He's the executive director of Samaritan Suicide Prevention Center right here in New York. The hotline number, by the way, is 212-673-3000. That's 212-673-3000, 24/7, 365, SamaritansNYC.org, SamaritansNYC.org. And we talked about some of the programs. The first one we mentioned was the public program. The other one I want to speak about that's very close and dear to my heart is the support programs, and that's how I was introduced to Samaritans. I lost my brother, as you know, 25 years ago. It's going to be 26. Isn't that crazy? So I went to a support group on the Upper West Side, my first form of any type of group gathering, therapy, quote-quote, whatever the case may be, and it was extremely helpful. Was it the Upper West Side, I think?
Yeah. You went to a safe place, a safe support group for survivors of suicide loss.
It was amazing, and it really, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what to get out of it, if it was going to be beneficial, self-serving, or a bunch of saps, you know, crying about, and of course, any meeting, AA, wherever you go, there's always one person stands out who wants to hold the floor. But it was a very, very therapeutic and healing process, and I'm forever thankful for the existence of Samaritans, certainly on that capacity alone.
Yeah, the support groups, I mean, if we look at the statistics today, which you were alluding to, which is suicide's the 10th leading cause of death. The latest statistics are something like 47,000 people die a year. And if you talk to look at medical examiner research, that's an underreport because a lot of suicides are hidden as accidents.
Yes.
But research tells us that anywhere from 6 to 10 people are directly impacted by every suicide. So there's millions of people. And again, it doesn't have to be as dramatic as suicide. Hmm. Suicide attempts, self-harming behavior, certainly you refer
ideation.
To the opioid crisis. But this is – we only allow people who have had a direct, personal – it's called safe place, and the only one allowed in the door is someone who has a direct, personal loss from someone who died from suicide. And it's kind of called a peer professional support group. Everyone comes from a Samaritan's background, so they have that befriending, non-judgmental communications focus. And it's a place for people to get together, and I facilitate Safe Place for that same period of time, over 25 years. And everyone always says, this is the only place I can really talk about what I'm feeling and going through, because even my friends who love me or my family – they just can't talk about it, or they don't know what to say, or they try to cheer me up. But this is the only place where I can be around people
level playing
who have you know, some semblance of a similar experience, and it truly is group support. And it's a great
absolutely.
Program.
I remember being there. I was 25 back then and being very, I guess, shy and obviously stricken with grief and so many different array of feelings. And it took me a while, I guess, to come out and speak. And I just remember looking forward to that meeting and or also being anxious about it as well, because, you know, it's something that was unknown to me. Obviously, the trauma of what I was going through, the grief, everything. And then I remember how light I would feel afterward. And then, you know, of course, as the week would go on, everything would pile back up and then you discharge again. So it's kind of a rinse and repeat cycle. What you don't know about me is that I'd say back in 1997, I started having panic attacks, major anxiety, rolled into depression, everything, the whole ideation. I knew I wasn't going to do it, went for help. So, you know, it was a rough patch. And I just remember feeling like, oh, my God, so this is what it's like. You know, all the different stigmas.
Misconceptions.
Not misconceptions. Actual sorry, I've been up since 4:30. Spin instructor. So nutball, not enough sleep, not enough food. Symptoms. Thank you, Mark. Symptoms. Had them all. And, you know, I got through it. I knew I was going to get through it. Intrusive thoughts, waiting for your subway to come through the platform. And next thing you know, I'd be envisioning myself jumping into the train tracks and, of course, break out into a full body sweat. All these different things were just, you know, overtaking my life in a gargantuan manner. And for like 3-4 weeks, Alan, I didn't tell a soul because I was so worried my family was going to think, oh, no, another Mike. This is what's going to happen.
Right.
And I had to work up that courage. And there's one thing I didn't think of is reaching out to a hotline, because I was just so in my own shell, in my own world, and that, you know, as you know, and a lot of listeners know, that you feel so isolated and alone and scary. But of course, I went through it once or twice, and you know, it's one of the things, as I do think you know, is that I speak now to schools and colleges, right, and corporations, and that's one of the topics, mental health. And I think it's vital, number one, to share the stories of positive outcomes. But number two, more importantly, I think, is the fact that I'm a male, that I do, I'm in media, that I'm not afraid to put myself out there so other people can learn and benefit.
Yeah, I mean, the isolation and exacerbates any problem you're having. It gets that kind of spiral effect. You know, the what if this, what if I can't get out of bed, what if this happens, what if my girlfriend leaves me?
What if work finds out?
What if,
how am I going to get through the day?
And then it spirals into the universe. So isolation is such a significant risk factor. And the message that you're taking, and I think one of the things that Samaritans and groups like us are advocating for is it's great to have these government programs and it's great to have clinical programs, but the fact is SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, the federal government's mental health arm, tells us that as many as 60% of the people who experience psychoanalytic problems, disorders, never receive any form of care or treatment. So one of the things we're constantly advocating for, and we're actually later today I'm talking to New York State legislators who are trying to help us do this, is to expand access, points of access to care. People will seek help in a way they're comfortable. You can't make someone, that was that word make.
There we go.
You can't make someone get help. You can't bully someone into – they may go once,
sure,
or whatever it is.
Provide options.
Yeah, and you will go where you're comfortable. That's why texting – that's why hotlines are good, or texting is good, or chat is good, or spiritual services. Or certainly no one's denigrating clinical and professional medical. But
not at all. Sure.
It truly is. Hmm. It takes a community.
Yes, absolutely.
And the bottom line is, if you're getting the best care you can in New York – you're going to see a therapist maybe once or twice a week. Maybe you'll be in a support group. Maybe you have some form of issue that requires medication, so you might see a psychopharmacologist once a month. You add all that together, it means once a week you got about an hour and a quarter, an hour and a half of care. What happens the other 23
hours? Not a lot
hours?
Of maintenance unless you're really vigilant on taking care of yourself.
But
in
you
that
still
capacity.
Need those
sure.
bridges, those
yes,
connections.
Absolutely.
So one of the things that a lot of us preach is a multiplicity. Yeah, therapy. Yes, there's a hotline. Yes, there's a chat service. If you looked at Barbara Stanley, who you know, prevention safety planning, is having some idea if this happens – what are points of access for me?
Structure.
If this happens, what can I do? And where the client, the patient, is deciding what ways to get help and care. And there's a much greater success rate in people accessing help when you have a multiplicity of forms of access. And Samaritans and many of us are on this agenda to enhance and advance community, volunteer, and humanistic services, not just clinical and medical.
Is this meeting with SAMHSA an initial meeting, or is this something?
It's not with SAMHSA. It's with some New York legislators trying to push this kind of concept in New York State to get communities to enhance their collaborations, their community actions, volunteer programs. In England, Samaritans has what's called the Flying Squad, which is a group of experts and practitioners and support people that in a moment can go somewhere when needed.
Wow, so a response team.
Kind of a response, yeah. A subject matter expert.
Fascinating.
And we get these calls all the time.
And how active are they?
Well, this is what we're trying to build.
Yes.
We have
but over in London, how active are they?
All over. They even have what's called the festival branch. You saw the You're not old enough to be an old hippie, but you have a sense
of Hey, I was going to talk about Woodstock. Yeah. Are you going to go to the 50th anniversary?
I saw that. Yes, I was at the original.
My respect for you has just gone up two pegs, Alan Ross. We're going. So, you and I. Come on, baby.
Well, we were thinking in England, they have the festival branch, which goes to different concerts, sets up a tent, so people have some place to go. And I'm going, hey, we should approach the people who are doing Woodstock and say we should set up a little tent there so people... You know, I remember
Absolutely.
At
Get
the original Woodstock, it was don't take the purple acid or...
hey, yeah. They were still looking out for lives back then.
Well, and actually, community. There was a lot of community action.
Yeah.
The National Guard, we had a van, and the National Guard came up to us and said, we need you to take your van and go around, and because it was raining and people were slipping and getting hurt, and they were taking... I can't say too much drugs. They were taking drugs to their detriment and were having depressive episodes and panic episodes.
Oh, yeah, crashing big time.
Right. So there were people, you know, in a non-structured manner
circulating.
Doing this kind of stuff. You know, Samaritans didn't create it.
You know, there's so many different things at festivals nowadays, and actually one of them I was going to get to in terms of how beneficial it's one of these studies shows and just reported that how music festivals and concerts actually – extend your life by 9 years. I think that's much a hoopla, but in terms of all the positive outcomes.
Right.
But number two, there's a lot of, and there's an organization I meant to have on the show that goes to a lot of major events like this, sponsor multi-day festivals for AA. Set up tents.
Yeah,
so if you know
yeah.
if you're dry and you still want to go, you shouldn't not have the not experience what you love if it's music your thing just because everyone around you is you know snot faced drunk. So you
that
can go
sure
there.
Make
and
it
cook.
A lot harder.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
the fact
yeah.
that it's just a sweaty, yeah. close, loud environment, and then you got all the beer being spilled on you. But the fact that you brought up that point, I think, is incredible because first of all, people could be more likely to be open and they don't have to even go out of their way. It's right there.
Right.
And they're very comfortable.
Yeah. And it points to the fact that, you know, everybody in some fashion can provide a helping hand. The work that the volunteers do at Samaritans on the hotline, and they go through pretty intensive training. We run six training programs a year. And we get about 300 applicants for each program. Once people see the requirements, that 300 immediately turns into 80.
And then after the training?
Well, not even that. Then the 80 interview, and we only accept like 35. And then by the time they get through training, if 40 to 50% make it through it, it's amazing.
Wow.
So,
how many are on staff right now as a volunteer?
We have approximately around 100 volunteers. And, you know, that's staggered across the 7-day, 24. But the thing that's remarkable, and I would encourage your listeners, whether they volunteer for Samaritan's Hotline, and we always need good, responsible, caring people who are communicative. But if it's not Samaritan's Hotline, another community hotline, a community group that provides support. We enhance protective factors when we put people on the front lines, whether it's Meals for Wheels or it's at outpatient programs, making links with hospitals when people are discharged. There's a tremendous high rate of suicide within 2 weeks of discharge from a health facility.
Absolutely, yeah.
So there's so many areas that community groups, that volunteers can do. And, you know, I can tell you I was a communications professional. I was a journalism faculty. My dream was to get a political piece in the New York Times. I was able to accomplish that. I made a living as a writer, and it was a shock to learn in some ways interpersonally how ineffective I was as a communicator. And I can say it changed my life.
When you aligned yourself with Samaritans.
When I went through the training, because it taught me to have, we're not a Zen organization, but some of the constants are to have great respect for that which you do not know.
Yeah.
To learn.
On any level.
On any level. Yeah. It's life lessons.
Yes, absolutely.
So
and people, sorry to interrupt you, Alan, because I want to make sure our listeners get this. And this actually is in most locations throughout the world, correct?
Well, hotlines, the Samaritans, yeah, but there are, whether they're Samaritans
here.
Or not, you know,
yes.
If you're in New York, volunteer for Samaritans. Yeah. But you know, there's 600 community crisis response and hotlines throughout the country, and the vast majority of them use volunteers in some fashion. So, like getting help, find a way to help that fits your values, your comfort, and your ability to perform. Don't sign up for something that you don't have the ability to do.
And whatever your background and age is, I mean, you have volunteers in their 20s up to their 70s. You have theater actors, you have engineers, people from Wall Street, all walks of life. Because, and that's even more reflective, LGBTQ, I mean, it makes it more diverse and more empathetic in terms of fielding calls.
Yeah, I mean, it's the UN.
It should be.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to look at the roster of volunteers, at one point, one of our staff, we've had people from 68 countries.
Wow.
Because some of them, hate to say, I wasn't sure that I even knew of. And I mean the people, I mean the country.
Yeah, sure.
And again, that diversity, it's from 21. We have people who are 75. At 67, I'm still not the most senior person.
Good for you. And you don't look a day over 50, that's for sure. At SamaritansNYC.org, SamaritansNYC.org for volunteer information. Another critical point I want to make sure our listeners understand, the programs, the support groups, how prevalent are they in all the Samaritan locations throughout the world?
Well, they're prevalent. I mean, Samaritans in North America started the first survivor support group. Actually, a man named Andrew Slaby, who's affiliated with AFSP and was a board member and supporter of Samaritans. But the bereavement survivor support movement, thanks to people like your mother and Iris Bolton and so many other people, is throughout the country. So you can find survivor support, AFSP, Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
In terms of Samaritans, that's who we're focused on today.
Right.
Yeah, I can be like that. You don't have to be like that.
Right.
That they can probably just Google their state and Samaritans, and it'll pop up whether there's a location near them.
But, you know, this is an example, and I appreciate and I do want to focus on Samaritans because we don't have anywhere near the gigantic funding that some of these organizations do. But that's the point we preach, which is break down the silos. Every organization should be sharing contacts and resources and information. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be if you do research or in a government program, you only get government referrals. You're in a nonprofit, you only get nonprofit. We want to be connecting all the dots
in
the safety net.
You're saving a life and improving lives. That should be the commonality.
And sharing resources because you need therapy, but you need someone you can call, and you need so as much of this networking, coalition, collaboration, again, strengthening a safety net.
Very cool. And also, lastly, in closing, Alan Ross, you have a lot of events. You have a half marathon you have participants in. You have a walk. There's all kinds of information, again, on SamaritansNYC.org. Any upcoming events?
Right now, our real focus, in all honesty, is it's getting harder to get good volunteers.
Yeah.
So almost all our efforts are focused on recruiting and finding good people. They can also call at 877-SUICIDE if they want to volunteer.
877-SUICIDE. And our hotline number, once again, is 212-673-3000, 212-673-3000. And very quickly, I was reading somewhere that one of the senators wants to create a national, like a 911 for mental health.
Right. There's actually a piece of legislation, federal legislation.
Pending.
Exploring hotlines roles, talking
about
expanding engagement.
Excellent.
So this is all
Alan Ross, thank you so much for your time and your steadfast work.
Thank you so much, Mark. Great to be here.
My name is Mark Farrell. If you'd like me to speak at your school, college, or corporation, check out markfarrellmotivation.com, markfarrellmotivation.com. Have a grand new year. We have a lot of great topics and host and guest on the way. Gary Knowles next. My name is Mark Farrell. Have a great day.